KRWG News this week. I'm Fred Martino. Thanks for being with us. We begin with the drug crisis and some possible solutions. Fentanyl test strips and better data may be a few of the many solutions to the opioid epidemic and our nation's spike in overdose deaths. The Mountain West News Bureau's Madeline Beck reports.
One tool to prevent overdose deaths is fentanyl test strips. They often look like little blue and white scraps of paper and work like a pregnancy test. One line shows up if there's fentanyl in a solution, two lines if there's none.
Fentanyl test strips are a very basic level of prevention.
Erin Porter works for a program that targets drug trafficking in Oregon and Idaho. She says Oregon health officials give test strips to users so they can tell whether their drugs have fentanyl in them.
The test strips are really sensitive, so what we want people to do is just test the residue.
They aren't perfect. Porter says fentanyl sticks together in pills and powders like chocolate chips and cookies. If you test a bit that isn't touching fentanyl, there's a chance the strip won't test positive. But, she says, people want to know what they're using, and many avoid fentanyl. It's not only deadly, but she says you often need to use fentanyl again faster to avoid withdrawal.
When someone is in the throes of substance use disorder, they're just trying to not be sick.
The CDC estimates there were more than 90,000 overdose deaths in the U.S. last year, a record. And health experts say a big factor was synthetic opioids like fentanyl. There are other efforts to avoid fentanyl deaths, too, like increasing access to naloxone, which can reverse opioid overdoses, or decreasing stigma around addiction and improving access to addiction treatment. But test strips are relatively low cost and may be easier to dole out than building new clinics or changing long-held stigmas. The strips can also change people's behavior.
Many of them took subsequent overdose prevention steps.
That's Jacqueline Goldman with Brown University. Goldman led a study in 2019 that showed young Rhode Island adults with the test strips did things like avoid drugs and used slower. The study had a small sample of about 90 people. Now Goldman is working on a larger clinical trial to give the federal government more guidance about test strips.
We will be recruiting 500 people who use drugs who are between ages of 18 and 65.
In April, federal agencies, including the CDC, said states could use federal grant money to buy fentanyl test strips. But there's a catch. Fentanyl test strips are actually illegal in many Mountain West states, like New Mexico, Utah, and Idaho. Drug tests are included in their definition of illegal drug paraphernalia. Nevada changed its law this year to allow for fentanyl test strips.
Aye. Any opposed? Motion passes unanimously.
Goldman says the tests could be helpful everywhere.
It's not just about giving the fentanyl test strips, but really showing people how, why they can be useful in preventing overdose.
But where are they needed most? It's hard to say with limited data. The Mountain West was the last region to feel the brunt of the opioid epidemic or fentanyl products. Like many other black markets, it spread from cities and the coasts to more rural areas. But now fentanyl is here and people are dying. Chris Gibson directs the Oregon-Idaho HIDA, or High Intensity Drug Trafficking Area. These federally funded HIDA programs are all over the U.S. They aim to reduce drug trafficking, increase interagency cooperation, and provide training. Gibson says his Oregon team has worked for decades on finding and aggregating data on overdoses and fentanyl, but states like Idaho and Montana have only had the last few years to start catching up.
One of the things that our program did was it funded, and it is funding, an intelligence analyst in Idaho.
That person would find and aggregate data from around the state once they're hired. But Gibson says they need faster data everywhere, even Oregon. It should be as close to real time as possible, so we know exactly where people are overdosing, when they're dying, and from what.
The more proactive you can be in getting out in front of something, the more likelihood you're going to have of having a positive impact.
So he's promoting tools like ODMAP, which allows first responders to log overdose information after assisting a victim. He says if we can at least track dangerous batches of drugs, states can work together to stop their spread and warn the public. For the Mountain West News Bureau, I'm Madeline Beck.
And you may have heard Madeline Beck on Morning Edition earlier this week. The Mountain West News Bureau will continue to cover this important issue, as will we at KRWG News. Funding for the Mountain West News Bureau is provided in part by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. If you have ideas for health reporting topics, including the drug crisis, the opioid epidemic in our nation, we do want to hear from you. You can email us anytime. The address is feedback@nmsu.edu. Well, next month's local elections are the first since New Mexico required counties provide a minimum number of secure ballot drop boxes. You may have had a chance to see some of these because Doña Ana County is a leader in the state. They have 7 of these boxes, exceeding the required minimum. But according to the Secretary of State's office, nearly half of counties won't have enough boxes, and the majority of those don't have permission. KUNM's Nash Jones has our report.
New Mexico counties have to provide one ballot drop box for every 25,000 registered voters, and regardless of size, must have at least 2 of them. Counties can request an exception to the rule from the Secretary of State's office. Elections Director Mandy V. Hill says 5 of the state's 33 counties did that and will have only 1 drop box, due mostly to staffing and geographical constraints. 10 other counties, however, are out of compliance with the policy.
We are going to be working towards compliance with the intention to have them fully implemented by the primary election.
That's next June. But for next month's election, the state says the largest county, Bernalillo, will have just 2 drop boxes. Based on KUNM's analysis of the most recent voter registration data, it should have 17. 6 counties, all majority Republican, chose not to provide any drop boxes this election. Vigil says that they argued that because of how the statute is written, they don't have to. Her office disagrees.
A voter isn't required to use it, but the county is required to provide it as an option.
Vigil says drop boxes are a safe way to vote during the pandemic and that data from other states show that they can increase voter turnout. She says she hopes counties will get on board after watching others use them successfully, and if not, her office is prepared to legally enforce the policy. For KUNM, I'm Nash Jones.
In Focus, Election 2021. We're going to talk about that and much more with Doña Ana County Clerk Amanda Lopez Askin. Amanda, thank you for being with us. We are getting ready for another Las Cruces municipal election, and there are also other elections in the county as well. The Las Cruces one, as you know, uses ranked choice voting in races of more than 2 people. Let's talk about the lessons learned from the last election and look ahead to this year.
Sure. So thank you for having me today. And as always, go Aggies, right? Fred, I appreciate you and I watch you religiously. So thank you for having me today. So yeah, let's talk about 2019. 2019, what I had to do was learn about ranked choice voting. And so I was a new clerk, ranked choice voting was new. There seemed to be a more air of excitement, quite frankly, in 2019 because there was a few things going on at once. 2019 was the first year we implemented the consolidated election. So New Mexico historically, they'd have school board elections in a February or March or watershed elections, kind of seemed random. And so what New Mexico decided to do was to enfold them into a common date, which is the first Tuesday after that first Monday. So every November like clockwork in New Mexico, we have elections now. And the hope is that moving forward, it will increase turnout, which did end up being true. What also added to the excitement was we had quite a few of mayoral candidates and other races that, or other in the city of Las Cruces.
It was 10, wasn't it? 10 yes, mayoral candidates.
Right. And in the interim, right, since 2019, I have the opportunity to actually, I testified at the Maryland legislature. I've done some national, webinars on ranked choice voting as an election administrator, as well as some podcasts. So I think the interest is up in the country and we're talking more about it. One of the things that I think is really important that I want to get across to voters is what I encountered in 2019 were some voters who were hesitant, suspicious, or frankly just did not like the change in the way the election was administered for the city of Las Cruces. And so those people need to be heard as well, and their concerns need to be validated in terms of that is how they feel. And then hopefully we offer information that makes it understandable, and they can see that It also is called instant runoff. We understand what runoffs are, and that makes kind of more sense to us. So the voter education piece also included me saying to voters, if ranking candidates will keep you away from the ballot box, then just vote what I call classic. Vote for the person you want to win and then move along to the rest of your ballot. And that's fine too. We just want you to show up. The point of it is to increase turnout. So we'd really hate for it to be discouraging to you. Recognize that if your candidate does not continue to within the other rounds, that you will have forfeited your right to be included in subsequent rounds or other runoffs that happen immediately, instant runoff. But we want you to vote. That is our priority. We want to make sure we do everything we can to engage you to vote.
I'm so glad you mentioned that, because you and I worked together on part of the media for that education campaign. And I think I had told you at the time that that was the most common question that I got was, do I have to, you know, rank every candidate? And the answer, of course, is no. If you only want to vote for one person, you can still do that. And it works. So very important to know that and to understand that. I want to touch on another issue, Amanda, that has gotten a lot of news that is not related to the upcoming election. It's the 2020 election. So many comments all over the country about threats, intimidation, attempts at an intimidation against election officials. And I know you had a personal experience with this.
You know, I have had various forms of hostility, anger. I have not had outright threats to my life. I've been, racist slurs have been used against me, whether that be people calling my phone line, direct phone line, and saying things, or sending me notes back for notices. We send as a courtesy to voters, and sending a note back to me and using, you know, just things I won't even mention. Social media in general has been full of a lot of that as well. I've had people tell me that I'm going to be locked up, that I'm a criminal. Have I had outright threats to my life? Thankfully, no. I know some election officials have dealt with that. I have not. There's been other more under the radar things that have been said to me and have happened that have been just deeply disappointing, deeply discouraging, and deeply concerning.
Words matter, and that's why I mentioned this. And to note that it's not a joke when we're talking about the very reason we can exist as a democracy, voting, and to try to intimidate the people who are doing their best to run elections is serious business. This has been talked about a lot, but there's still some of this going on. There's still a lot of, amazingly to some folks, there's still a lot of misinformation going out there too, sometimes by prominent people. What do you think is the effect of that?
It is, I say this quite often, Fred. I've been an active voter since I was 18. I was very encouraged by my mother. I bet you've been an active voter as long as you've been able to vote. People watching this likely are active voters, but there are folks that may not be as in tune. And so I think it's the most harmful to them, because they may be on the fence about participating. They may be like, I should vote. Maybe I'm going to vote. I'm going to look into it. And then they get these messages that their vote doesn't matter. There's something wrong with the process. And those generally are people, you know, who are they're younger or older, rural, socioeconomically challenged, gay. Those are all of the folks that tend to kind of sit back and not participate. And basically, I call it the table of democracy, not sit with us at the table of democracy. That is the most damaging. But I'm gonna add to that, Fred, and give you some context. So I say this, and I've said this more recently, increasingly, is I was born in Doñana County. I went to the school formerly known as Oñate High School. I'm a three-time Aggie. I've served my community in many capacities. I'm a huge animal advocate and volunteer. I'm not trying to make this about me and I'm so great, but what I'm trying to say is I am part of this community. I'm embedded here. My husband's a retired law enforcement officer. I have a 5-year-old daughter that I'm choosing to raise here. I am deeply committed to my community. And so what just astounds me is the just casual inference or outright accusation that I'm a criminal. Because what people don't recognize is every single act of voter fraud is a 4th-degree felony. So this casual indifference that they think that I have is just, that's outrageous to me. We take our job very seriously. We have an amazing staff. I have an amazing Chief Deputy, Lindsay Bachman, who helps me lead this office. And I am every day fighting a battle with folks who are giving misinformation and are being incredibly damaging in a lot of different ways. So we fight it as much as we can. One thing I will say, I would encourage you to look up the MIT Election Index. MIT does a ranking of elections and how they're administered, and it includes a lot of different factors, including turnout, security measures, checks and balances, best practices, all the things in elections that make them good. And we're not ranked high in a lot of lists, right? We think about, I've worked in healthcare, education, a lot of different sectors that we have some work to do. We could be 45th to 50th. We rank number 9 on the MIT scale. And that really speaks a lot about New Mexico, how we are voter centric, how we are continuing to advocate for voters and make it easier and do everything we can to support the idea that every voice is valuable and we want you to be engaged with our democracy.
And part of making it easier, I know the clerk's office recently announced new secure drop boxes for ballots. Yeah. Tell me about those.
So in 2020, as you know, the absentee rate increased dramatically, and we were happy about that because it meant that people were staying home and staying safe. Last year, what we did was offer literally where were drop boxes that were staffed at each location, early voting as well as election day. These are different. These are secured containers. I'm always very careful to call them secured containers because in statute there are so many requirements that we have to meet. It's like a mailbox. We have safeguards, including security. They're monitored. We collect ballots at regular intervals during the day. They're enhanced. There's such a security items connected to it that it's not literally. I don't want to refer to it as drop boxes, just because that almost. I want you always use that secured containers. It's a.
And that's why I called it that in the question.
Thank you. You're good. You're on the same page.
Just to make sure people understand. So if they're concerned about putting their absentee ballot in the U.S. mail, they have this option. They can use the secure drop box. So it's really good, and it makes it convenient. But at the same time, we have all over the country continuing objections, mostly by Republicans, to expanding voter access with absentee ballots and other measures. What do you make of that?
Well, what I continue to say is we need to offer information about the process and the checks and balances and what's already embedded as far as security. So currently in New Mexico, you cannot obtain an absentee ballot unless you have a valid registration on file, which includes the ID requirement. There's also misinformation that New Mexico does not require ID, and that's just not true. There's a process that people have to apply for an absentee ballot. It has to go through a vetting process within our system. Then the applicant must sign and attest under a 4th-degree felony that this is them. So, I mean, I don't know how many people are willing to do that, but if they are and get any information that it is something that is, has any kind of concern about it, we investigate it and we do our best to, we will always prosecute anyone to the extent of the law that we can, because I think clerks and election administrators across the country are more against voter fraud than anybody else.
Absolutely. In particular, as you know, our neighboring state of Texas is at the center of a controversy over new voting restrictions there. What do you make of that Texas law?
You know, I've talked to election administrators in Texas. I was at a conference recently I've been at a few actually where we've talked about this, and their job and their life work is often to give voters access to help people that have the most difficulty in getting to the ballot box for whatever the reason is. And so I know election administrators, at least the ones I've talked to, are deeply concerned. I think that, you know, it is, I feel very much for voters who are seeing that pulled away and feel helpless. Again, I think it really just kind of doubles down on the work that the clerks in New Mexico do connected to election administration and how we will do everything we can to make it as secure and accessible as possible.
Yeah, and you talked about that earlier, that, you know, New Mexico is such a contrast to Texas in that New Mexico has actually expanded voter access,
yes,
including a same-day registration, which I know will happen during early voting. Tell me about that.
Sure. So same-day voter registration is basically you leading up to the Saturday before elections, and this may change next year. Keep in mind, election law does change frequently. But this year, up to the Saturday before the election, and you know, you're NMSU, you're an Aggie, you know, some of these students maybe haven't tuned in as much as we have connected to elections. If they, you know, the Saturday before election day, they want to register to vote and they haven't quite, they didn't make the deadline for online, which has passed, they can head to a polling location. They must have an ID, something that shows their proof of address, a bill, utility bill, things like that. They have to prove who they are and be able to vote, but they are able to register to vote. Again, that is a best practice and something that we're very proud of. And I am hopeful, and I can just speak for myself, that it will expand into Election Day in 2020.
Yeah, I know a lot of people are hoping for that because there has been data, as you know, where other states have done this, and it increases voter turnout, which, while it increased in 2020, voter turnout is still, some would call, pathetic. I mean, compared to many other countries, where
yeah,
most people vote, and in, as you know, there's even countries like Australia where it's required. It's part of your oath of citizenship, in a sense, that you, you know, being a good citizen, you vote.
Yes.
Closing thoughts in our last minute or so here, Amanda, on the municipal elections coming up. They often get ignored, and voter turnout can be much lower in those races. And it's a real shame because they have a big impact.
Yes, and I think they, frankly, they affect us more than we know that they do until we're experiencing an ordinance or something that affects our daily life, and we're like, ah, maybe I should have voted in that race. I don't support that decision by that leader. Or I really do, and I'm glad they did it. In Doñana County, our municipalities include Sunland Park, the town of Mesilla, the city of Anthony, the city of Las Cruces, and the village of Hatch. The only ranked choice voting races are within the city of Las Cruces. There's also school board races and watershed district races. So everybody in New Mexico, if you're listening and you're a registered voter in Doñana County, you have a ballot waiting for you once you head to a polling location. So I just want to reiterate that, although we tend to focus on the city of Las Cruces because, of course, it's the largest municipality, they have ranked choice voting, know that we have elections all over Doñana County that we hope that you participate in.
Amanda Lopez-Askin is the Doña Ana County Clerk. Amanda, thank you so much for being with us today, and in particular, speaking about some tough issues, that including ones that have affected you personally. I know that's not easy to do that, and we appreciate you doing that and educating people that this is serious business, and you take it seriously.
Well, Fred, this is the thing. What I think election administrators, including our own Secretary of State, have dealt with the last year has been just probably, they probably wouldn't have believed it had somebody told them even the year prior that this would be the situation. But for most of us, we've doubled down on doing the right thing for our community, for our region and our state, that we are going to have fair and free elections, and that we are going to offer information that we hope engages everybody eligible to vote.
Thanks, Amanda.
Thank you. Appreciate you.
And if you missed any of that conversation with Doñana County Clerk Amanda Lopez-Askin, you can watch it tomorrow morning at 11 on KRWG-TV's Newsmakers. It is a special election-related show. We will also have a couple of outstanding reports from our KRWG public media scholars. Noah Race profiles Las Cruces City Councilor Gabe Vasquez. You may have heard his report on the radio recently. You'll see it on Newsmakers. Of course, Vasquez is running for the Democratic nomination for Congress. He hopes to take on Republican incumbent Yvette Harrell. Sarah Rodriguez will also have a report for us on Newsmakers. She talked with students at New Mexico State University in a report on the effort in New Mexico and across the country to encourage more young people to vote, an incredibly important issue for sure. And early voting that is underway in our municipal elections is certainly getting very busy. We're seeing that at New Mexico State University, where there's an early voting polling place at Corbett Center. That's not only open to students, but open to the public. Well, speaking of politics, we have that in commentary for you this week. New Mexico's state treasurer has questioned a move by Governor Michelle Lujan Grisham. We have some thoughts from commentator Walt Rubel.
State Treasurer Tim Eichenberg has apparently decided that if the weak and subservient New Mexico legislature will not stand up for itself, he'll do it for them. Eichenberg, who previously served in the state Senate, has written a court brief in support of a lawsuit filed by two state senators, Republican Greg Baca and Democrat Jacob Candelaria, challenging the authority of Governor Michelle Lujan Grisham to spend federal relief money without going through the legislative process. The governor's office says the state constitution only gives the legislature the authority to appropriate state funds, not federal funds such as those flowing through the recently passed pandemic relief bill. They say a court ruling nearly 50 years ago regarding federal funding for universities backs up that position. Eichenberg says that's a misreading of the Constitution. But his most effective argument was not to the law, but rather to good government. Removing the legislature from the process would allow disbursement of public funds without necessary oversight and public accountability, he argued. But it's not clear that the legislature wants the authority being sought, or could quickly and effectively appropriate those funds if given that authority. Baca undoubtedly has the support of all members of the Republican caucus, but Candelaria just as undoubtedly does not have the support of his fellow Senate Democrats. Senate Finance Committee Chairman George Munoz, who's one of the most conservative Democrats left in the Senate following the 2020 election, said only that it would be good to have a ruling by the Supreme Court on the issue. Democrats in the legislature made it clear during this year's session that they will not act to defend their constitutional powers if those powers are being taken by a governor from their own party. A bill by Baca would have empowered the Legislative Council Committee, which is made up of leaders from both parties and meets once a month, to vote on any emergency order issued by the governor after 45 days. The bill was heavily amended during the committee process through good faith negotiations on both sides. Democrats who helped shape that final bill and supported it in the committee voted against it after the governor threatened a veto. There's always going to be a power imbalance between a part-time legislature that works either 30 or 60 days a year versus a governor's office that's going year-round. None of this should be seen as a criticism of how Governor Lujan has exercised her emergency powers or spent the federal money. But if our democracy calls for three co-equal branches, no one person should have that power alone. With this week's commentary, I'm Walt Rubel.
Walt Rubel's opinions are his own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KRWG or NMSU. KRWG News this week. I'm Fred Martino. So great to be with you. Dozens of banners in downtown Austin, San Antonio, Houston, and Dallas, and coming soon to El Paso, celebrate a major 30th anniversary. The inauguration of the state's last Democratic and woman governor, Ann Richards. Texas Public Radio's Brian Kirkpatrick reports.
The banners feature Ann Richards' image and some of her words to live by. They're the work of the Ann Richards Legacy Foundation. Richards served as governor from 1991 to 1995. She had big white hair, miles of Texas twang, and a sharp wit. The founder of her Legacy Foundation, her former deputy press secretary, Margaret Justice, says Richards was best known for her political toughness.
She was really brave when it came to the public policy issues that she took on. You know, they weren't the most popular things, but criminal justice reform, you know, school finance. She tried to curb gun violence. She brought ethics reform.
Among Richards' quotes, "You can put lipstick on a pig and call it Monique, but it's still a pig." A reference to what she considered wasteful spending by the White House then. Richards died at age 73 from cancer in 2006. I'm Brian Kirkpatrick in San Antonio.
To local politics now, and the Las Cruces City Council has unanimously approved a sculpture design for the new Animal Services Center of the Mesilla Valley facility. And city councilors this week also discussed an expansion of the downtown farmers and crafts market. In depth, here's Madison Staten.
An original public art project is being commissioned for the new Animal Services Center of the Mesilla Valley facility, which is set to open its doors in the fall of 2022. Out of 139 submissions, the City Art Board recommended artist Vito Dabari's concept art for city approval. The Las Cruces City Council voted unanimously to authorize the estimated $68,000 project, which is being supported through GeoBond funding. In an artist statement read by City Art Program Coordinator Ceci Vasconcelos, Dabari says the steel sculpture will incorporate laser-cut patterns and feature animals cared for by the Animal Services Center.
My installation features a representation of a cat and dog, beloved domestic pets, and two of the primary animals cared for by the ASCMB. The 9-foot-tall sculpture sees the two animals side by side, looking lovingly towards each other, radiating an energy of warmth and companionship. Directly behind them is the silhouette of a sun with a cutout depicting a majestic bird flying overhead.
Dabari describes the sculpture, titled Sun Shelter, as a visual embodiment of the center's values.
The symbolic elements, such as the sun, which is an emblem of protection that shines bright upon the animals, embody values of humane animal care and promote responsible pet ownership.
The City Art Board is evaluating if extra lighting will be needed for the project and will work with the artists following an official site visit. City Art Program Coordinator Ceci Vasconcelos says the board is also recommending design modifications to protect against the elements.
Recommendations from the Art Selection Committee are: number one, modify the single steel sheet design to a layered concept to add stability against the wind load. They felt that the cutouts would not be enough to withstand the wind, especially in that location. And number two, add lighting to the design so it can be seen at night. The artist did not include it because he thought ambient lighting would be enough, and it might be. We will look at the design, and once the artist comes out and looks at the site and finalizes that design, we'll decide if we need additional lighting for the piece.
Las Cruces City Councilors also discussed the need to expand the current farmers and crafts market of Las Cruces, with Councilor Cassandra Gondra directing City Manager Ifo Pili to explore the logistics of opening a Sunday market.
Really excited to see our farmers market just really exploding. I think it's an exciting time, Ifo, to work on possibly a Sunday market as well. Would love to see an evening market on Wednesdays, yes, but I think there's some room for a Sunday market. I know there's a long list of vendors who would like to get into the market.
Councillor Gil Sorg also advocated for a market expansion, saying agricultural producers might benefit from a night market that would not interfere with harvesting. Currently, the market operates every Wednesday and Saturday from 8:30 a.m. to 1 p.m.
I appreciate the comment on evening farmers markets. I had a vision that the farmers that bring produce to the farmers market might appreciate harvesting it all day long and selling it that evening instead of either getting up real early in the morning or the day before.
For KRWG Public Media, I'm Madison Staten.
To immigration news now, and the Biden administration has announced that it is putting an end to so-called worksite immigration raids. In a memo, Secretary of Homeland Security Alejandro Mayorkas said his department would instead crack down on unscrupulous employers who take advantage of undocumented workers. As KERA's Stella Chavez reports, some employee advocates are cautiously optimistic about this policy change.
Some of the country's largest workplace raids have taken place in North Texas in recent years. Around the country, hundreds of workers have been detained at job sites. Shayna Cotter is an attorney with the Equal Justice Center in Dallas. The group represents low-income workers. She says those enforcement actions often traumatize communities that are already hesitant to speak out because of their immigration status.
I think that in the past, what we've seen is that the workers, their families, their communities that have been torn apart and traumatized by the raids, that's where we see that long-lasting impact. But we've seen very little in terms of actual efficacy of deterring the sort of wrongful conduct on the part of the employer.
Cotter says some workers worry employers will go after them and their loved ones. She says the federal government should do more to protect workers who want to report abusive employers. I'm Stella Chavez in Dallas.
To environmental news now. And in the last few weeks, about 3 million acres of land across the U.S. was burning in wildfires. And though it may have felt like a lot worse than average year for wildfires in the country, it's actually been a little below average. Keeping wildfires at bay is an important and demanding job, but it's a field made up mostly of men. The Texas Standard's Jill Ament joined a group of teenage girls at a weekend program aimed at changing that.
On a clear, breezy day, a group of girls in their early and late teens are lining up in front of a couple of fire trucks tucked away in Smithville, Texas's piney woodlands. They're learning how to use low-powered fire hoses and are getting drenched in the process. These girls are part of the inaugural class of the Texas A&M Forest Service's Sisters in Fire program. It's run solely by women wildland firefighters and is open only to teen girls interested in the field.
This has been a great experience working with some people my age, and I'd probably do it again next year.
16-year-old Chesley Tanner has been learning how to start a chainsaw, what it's like to operate a bulldozer. Women represent a little more than 7% of all U.S. firefighters. When it comes specifically to wildfire fighting jobs, that number is a bit higher, but not by much. About 12% of positions with the U.S. Forest Service, Bureau of Land Management, and National Park Service focused on wildland firefighting are occupied by women. Texas A&M Forest Service says 10% of their wildland firefighters are women. Nicole Lang thinks all those numbers are too low.
It's an amazing job, and I love it, and a lot of these girls absolutely love their jobs, and we just want to let it be known to other women.
Lang is a regional fire coordinator for the Texas A&M Forest Service's Houston office. She thinks one of the reasons why there are so few women in her field is that they just don't think it's a career open to them.
So we're really underrepresented, and we really just want to get that out there to young girls that this is a career opportunity for them.
That's why she created Sisters in Fire, and she got 22 other women who work in wildland firefighting in Texas to be instructors for its inaugural event. About 30 teens joined them.
So they're having a blast. I can hear them hooting and hollering and, yelling go team and all of that. They're having an amazing time, and so are we. It's amazing.
And seriously, with all of your side muscles, with your shoulder muscles, you're going to pull it as hard as you can.
There's a lot of girl power on display here. As an instructor helps her start a chainsaw, 13-year-old Maylin Backus is sporting a t-shirt with a picture of Tootsie Tominitz, the legendary female pitmaster at Snow's Barbecue in Lexington, Texas.
Was that hard?
The pulling the chainsaw?
Yeah.
Yes.
Backus is not sure if wildland firefighting is something she wants to do for a career, but she's enjoyed having an opportunity to learn more about it.
But this is interesting. I can see why people would like to choose this as a career path, because it's fun. It's scary, but fun.
When asked if she thinks these activities are exclusive for boys, she immediately starts shaking her head no.
I think everybody can do whatever they want. There shouldn't be any gender-defining roles.
After a day full of hands-on learning, the program instructors demonstrate a controlled burn. It's kind of like fighting fire with fire. During dry spells or in areas that are wildfire prone, wildland firefighters go out every so often and burn off dead brush and weeds, things that can be fuel for a wildfire. The instructors all have numerous stories about experiences on controlled burns and responding to wildfires across the country. The burn was the final activity of the day, and the parents have now gathered to await the program's release.
I can't wait to hear all the stories on the way home, so.
Mary Onakovich drove 3.5 hours from the Gulf Coast city of Bay Cliff to bring her daughter and three other girls to today's event.
You know, we did this as a little girls' trip, and it's a girls only.
All of the girls are junior cadets with the Bay Cliff Volunteer Fire Department. Onakovich says her daughter wants to be a firefighter, but she says it's been hard to find good programs for young girls who want to break into the field.
I'm excited about all the adventures my kids take, so to see her being able to kind of grow in what she's found is her path for now, it's really nice.
She plans to bring her daughter back to the program when it meets for the second time next year.
Thank you guys so much, and we hope to see you at the next Sisters in Fire.
Thank you.
In Smithville, Texas, I'm Jill Ament.
KRWG News this week, I'm Fred Martino. Thank you for being with us. Arlington High School has resumed classes after it became the site of the most recent school shooting earlier this month. The shooting came after a Texas law permitting open carry of handguns without a license took effect, and weeks before the U.S. Supreme Court will take up its first major Second Amendment case in more than a decade. Here's Roz Brown from the Texas News Service.
A Texas law took effect September 1st, allowing residents who are 21 years of age or older to carry handguns in public without a license. The Arlington High School student involved in the shooting was 18. Brady United Against Gun Violence President Chris Brown says it's alarming that once again, back to school has meant back to school shootings.
This is a uniquely American epidemic, and as a parent, I'm disgusted that we continue to live this way.
On November 3rd, the U.S. Supreme Court will hear oral arguments in a major Second Amendment case that centers on whether the Constitution guarantees the right to carry guns outside the home. Brown says between August 1st and September 15th, there have been at least 30 instances of gunfire on school grounds, killing 5 and wounding more than 20 people.
The culture is, well, of course, the way to solve conflicts is to bring a gun. And we have solutions to this sitting before us, and we're not acting on them.
While the permitless carry law easily passed the Texas legislature, Brown notes that police associations were opposed.
It's law enforcement across the state of Texas who were most vocal in saying, please don't overturn the permitting system that has worked really well.
The number of shootings in Texas, not including suicides, increased 14% this year, according to data compiled by the Gun Violence Archive. For Texas News Service, I'm Roz Brown.
It's been a little over a year since former Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg's death. KERA's Elizabeth Myong spoke to her son, who runs a record label, about her life and legacy.
James Ginsburg says his mother was a champion for equal rights, not just women's rights.
You know, a lot of the cases she took, she showed how these laws that were supposedly favoring women actually not only held down women, but also held down men.
Ginsburg was in town for a concert hosted by the Dallas Symphony Orchestra, honoring his mother. He reflected on the impact of her work and moments of fun. He especially enjoyed watching his mother, who was once shy, embrace her public persona.
Particularly, I just remember one moment, which is in the RBG documentary, where she is being shown for the first time Kate McKinnon's caricature of her on Weekend Update, and she is in stitches. And that is just, you know, so wonderful to see.
Ginsburg served 27 years on the Supreme Court. In her 80s, she became a cultural icon nicknamed Notorious RBG. I'm Elizabeth Myong in Dallas.
Well, the Supreme Court will be the focus of our issue on the Health Watch this week, and it is an issue that continues to cause consternation and various lawsuits across the country. Senate Bill 8, the restrictive Texas abortion law that went into effect in September, sparked 660 protests across the country on October 9th, including one in Lubbock. In that West Texas city, abortions have been banned since June. That is when a local ordinance created a pathway for private citizens to sue anyone who helps someone get an abortion. The same basic tactic behind the state law. Texas Tech Public Media's Casey Ellingson talked with three Lubbock women fighting for reproductive rights.
Inside Lubbock's Planned Parenthood clinic, Director Angela Martinez unpacks one of the small blue bags the group's been handing out since SB 8 took effect.
It comes with emergency contraception.
They're called empowerment kits.
Pregnancy tests, condoms, and then a little palm card, just letting people know what the new restrictions are.
These kits, Martinez says, are one way Planned Parenthoods across Texas are working within the confines of the new state law. The Lubbock clinic we're standing in is relatively new. It just opened last October. Martinez says by April this year, the clinic had started offering medicinal abortions. Prior to that, the region had been without an abortion provider for 7 years, but that only lasted 5 weeks.
It's weird to talk about the timeline of the past year and the hurdles that the Lubbock Health Center has had to go through.
The city's measure, dubbed the Sanctuary City for the Unborn Ordinance, took effect on June 1st. Now, Martinez says the clinic's biggest challenge is getting out the message about other things they do.
We want people to know that we're here. We want people to know that, you know, we're offering as many services as we can.
Services like STD testing and treatment, cancer screening, and giving out birth control. While this may be a conservative part of Texas, Martinez and Planned Parenthood still have like-minded allies, including Lubbock artist Trisha Earle. She's using her artwork to raise money and inform people.
Let me lay these out real quick.
Earle flips through stacks of hand-printed posters in all sizes, pulling out a small rectangular one with the words, "I am Jane," printed in bold block letters. On the back of each I Am Jane poster, Earle includes contact info for three organizations: Women's Protective Services, Lubbock's Rape Crisis Center, and Planned Parenthood.
Oh yeah, everyone always asks me, well, who is Jane? Well, Jane can be any of us. So why not have a poster that says I Am Jane, so therefore you can explain to someone who asks you when they see it.
She tells me the series was inspired by a group from Illinois in the early 70s.
The women were finding that a lot of other women did not know where to go, who to talk to, specifically around reproductive health. So they began a group of women, four women. It was called the Jane Collective.
That story resonates with Earle. She says she's always been approached by people needing help, whether for an abortion or just getting birth control.
I'm being asked these questions more than I've ever thought I would ever be.
At last Saturday's rally against SB 8 in Lubbock, Earle's posters were on sale at Planned Parenthood's booth, $10 each, with all proceeds going to the clinic. Kim Gonzalez organized the event. She's worked in healthcare for more than 25 years and only recently became an activist.
When RBG died, it really hit me. And I realized that I need to do more than just vote and watch the news. And so, I started showing up.
She started by showing up at the public hearing the Lubbock City Council held when they were considering the local abortion ban. Gonzalez was one of a few people there supporting Planned Parenthood. Saturday's rally is the biggest thing she's organized so far, and even made a speech.
Fighting for this. Our grandmothers fought for us to have this right 40 years ago, 40 years plus. Why are we still fighting this fight?
Like Trisha Earle and Angela Martinez, Gonzalez says she'll continue using her platform to inform people about their reproductive health options. She says her top priority right now is getting people to urge their reps to fight for the Women's Health Protection Act, a measure recently passed by the U.S. House of Representatives. I'm Casey Ellingson in Lubbock.
Show me what democracy looks like. This is what democracy looks like. Show me what democracy looks like.
Finally this week, earthquake activity has increased dramatically in southern New Mexico, likely due to injection wells in the Permian Basin. They're used to store wastewater produced during oil and gas drilling. Jerry Redfern covers the industry for the publication Capital in Maine, and he broke the story. Redfern talked with KUNM's Megan Kamrick.
Oil and gas drilling down there brings up 4 to 10 times more of this briny water than it actually brings up oil and gas. And as Adrian Sandoval from the New Mexico Oil Conservation Division told me, well, you got to do something with it. What they figured out to do is drill these deep injection wells and just jam that brine back into the ground.
How do we know for sure this is causing the earthquakes?
They're able to track where people are doing these injection wells, how much they're injecting, and then essentially follow the increase in seismicity that comes after that, where there wasn't, say, any before. And it's now pretty well studied and known, I think mainly because of a series of earthquakes that happened starting in the early 2000s and on up through 2015 in Oklahoma, where they had some really big earthquakes that they were able to very closely tie to injection wells there.
How much water are we talking about?
Yeah, it's mind-boggling amounts of water. As I put in the story, it's at this point, last year, there was more water injected under the ground in the Permian Basin just in New Mexico than there is water in Elephant Butte. We should be clear, too, that Elephant Butte's running at like 6% capacity because of climate change, because of drilling oil and gas out of the ground and burning it. But the main thing is it's an awful lot of water.
These earthquakes are barely perceptible to ordinary folks, but researchers at New Mexico Tech are really paying attention to them. Why?
When you start seeing increases in lots of small quakes, all of a sudden, it tends to lead to bigger quakes and then bigger quakes after that. It's not like cumulative, but it indicates that things are moving around underground and might continue to do so if you keep doing the same stuff.
Southern New Mexico is home to the waste isolation pilot plant, and there are more nuclear facilities planned near or over the Texas state line. Are these earthquakes happening in those areas? Is that of concern?
Oh, they're happening nearby. There's a fellow who works at, he's the manager at the Texas Seismological Network, Dr. Savaitis, and he was telling me that quakes can actually travel, that you can have an injection well in one spot, but the quake actually shows up miles and miles away. So while the quakes that have been noted so far in, say, New Mexico aren't near the WIP plant, and they're not necessarily close to the Urenco plant or the other two facilities that they're considering putting in there, there are injection wells around all of these. And especially on the Texas border, there's just a ton of them. About the same day that my story came out, Texas shut down a series of injection wells because they tied them to a series of mid-level quakes in Texas near Midland.
Well, what kinds of regulations or guidelines are there for seismic activity around oil and gas?
Coming from the state, nothing in particular. When I was talking again with Adrian Sandoval, the director at the Oil Conservation Division, she was saying that she does have actually a great deal of discretion in being able to shut things down. Like to tell operators, you need to slow your injections down. You need to close this particular well. Like what happened in Texas, where you suddenly have a dramatic increase in very noticeable quakes around a populated area. We haven't really got to that point yet. And there's not much that seems to be on the books about how to sort of quake-proof wells, I guess you'd call it. I guess it's, you know, another in a litany of things that comes along with developing oil and gas. We want the energy, you know, we want the gas that goes in the cars, we want the natural gas that heats our homes. And it comes with an awful lot of sort of external factors, and this is one of them. It's not stuff that you can just spread on the ground. It's super, super, super saline, much saltier than ocean water. It's often radioactive because it's been underground and picks up radon as it comes up. If you're to put it on the ground, you're going to sterilize the ground. And then it has a tendency to dry up and blow those salts all over the place, which is unhealthy for anybody living nearby. So the least worst solution, I guess, is to re-inject it.
Well, Jerry Redfern, thanks for talking with me today.
Well, thanks for having me on, Megan. That was great.
That's KRWG News this week. I'm Fred Martino. Thanks so much for spending part of your Saturday with us. Broadcasting from New Mexico State University, KRWG Las Cruces, and KRXG Silver City. Join us for the latest news anytime at krwg.org.